legs, and when she bent to the ground and kicked up her feet, it looked as delicate as a spider walking a wall. Me? I sort of defied gravity with a thud. We balanced in silence for a few seconds. I wish my head was flatter, I said, as I felt my eyebrows scrunch down. Do you think there's a man who'll come to the house to time us, or do we just mail a videotape? I guess they'll let us know. Kate folded her arms along the carpet. Do you think we'll be famous? We might get on the Today Show. They had that 11-year-old kid who could play the piano with his feet. She thought for a second. Mom knew someone who got killed by a piano falling out a window. That's not true. Why would anyone push a piano out a window? It is true, you ask her. And they weren't taking it out, they were putting it in. She crossed her legs against the wall, so that it looked like she was just sitting upside down. What do you think is the best way to die? I don't want to talk about this, I said. Why? I'm dying. You're dying. When I frowned, she said, well, you are. Then she grinned. I just happen to be more gifted at it than you are. This is a stupid conversation. Already it was making my skin itch in the places I knew I would never be able to scratch. Maybe in an airplane crash, Kate mused. It would suck, you know, when you realized you were going down, but then it happens and you're just powder. How come people get vaporized, but they still manage to find clothes in trees and those black boxes? By now, my head was starting to pound. Shut up, Kate. She crawled down the wall and sat up, flushed. There's just sleeping through it as you croak, but that's kind of boring. Shut up, I repeated, angry that we had only lasted about 22 seconds, angry that now we were going to have to try for a record all over again. I tipped myself sunny side up again and tried to clear the knot of hair out of my face. You know, normal people don't sit around thinking about dying. Liar, everyone thinks about dying. Everyone thinks about you dying, I said. The room went so still, I wondered if we ought to go for a different record. How long can two sisters hold their breath? Then a twitchy smile crossed her face. Well, Kate said, at least now you're telling the truth. Jesse gives me a $20 bill for the cab fare home, because that's the only hitch in his plan. Once we go through with this, he isn't going to be driving back. We take the stairs up to the 8th floor instead of the elevator, because they let us out behind the nurse's station, not in front of it. Then he tucks me inside a linen closet filled with plastic pillows and sheets stamped with the hospital's name. Wait, I blurt out when he's about to leave me. How am I going to know when it's time? He starts to laugh. You'll know. Trust me. He takes a silver flask out of his pocket. It's one my father got from the chief and thinks he lost 3 years ago. Screws off the cap and pours whiskey all over the front of his shirt. Then he starts to walk down the hall. Well, walk would be a loose approximation. Jesse slams like a billiard ball into the walls and knocks over an entire cleaning cart. Ma, he yells out. Ma, where are you? He isn't drunk, but he sure as hell can do a great imitation. It makes me wonder about the times I've looked out my bedroom window in the middle of the night and seen him puking in the rhododendrons. Maybe that was all for show, too. The nurses swarm out from their hive of a desk, trying to subdue a boy half their age and three times as strong, who, at that very moment, grabs the uppermost tier of a linen rack and pulls it forward, making a crash so loud it rings in my ears. Call buttons start ringing like an operator's switchboard behind the nurse's desk, but all three of the night duty ladies are doing their best to hold Jesse down while he kicks and flails. The door to Kate's room opens, and bleary-eyed, my mother steps out. She takes a look at Jesse, and for a second her whole face is frozen with the realization that, in fact, things can get worse. Jesse swings his head toward her, a great big bull, and his features melt. "Hi, Mom," he greets, and he smiles loosely up at her. "I am so sorry," my mother says to the nurses. She closes her eyes as Jesse stumbles upright and throws his sloppy arms around her. "There's coffee in the cafeteria," one nurse suggests, and my mother is too embarrassed to even answer her. She just moves toward the elevator banks, with Jesse attached to her like a muscle on a crusty hull, and pushes the down button over and over in the fruitless hope that it will actually make the doors open faster. When they leave, it is almost too easy. Some of the nurses hurry off to check the patients who've rung in. Others settle back behind their desk, trading hushed commentary about Jesse and my poor mother like it's some card game. They never look my way as I sneak out of the linen closet, tiptoe down the hall, and let myself into my sister's hospital room. One Thanksgiving, when Kate was not in the hospital, we actually pretended to be a regular family. We watched the parade on TV, where a giant balloon fell prey to a freak wind and wound up wrapped around an NYC traffic light. We made our own gravy. My mother brought the turkey wishbone onto the table, and we fought over who would be granted the right to snap it. Kate and I were given the honors. Before I got a good grip, my mother leaned close and whispered in my ear, "You know what to wish for." So I shut my eyes tight and thought hard of remission for Kate. Even though I had been planning to ask for a personal CD player, and got a nasty satisfaction out of the fact that I did not win the tug of war. After we ate, my father took us outside for a game of two-on-two touch football while my mother was washing the dishes. She came outside when Jesse and I had already scored twice. "Tell me," she said, "that I am hallucinating." She didn't have to say anything else. We'd all seen Kate tumble like an ordinary kid and wind up bleeding uncontrollably like a sick one. "Oh, Sarah." My dad turned up the wattage on his smile. "Kate's on my team. I won't let her get sacked." He swaggered over to my mother and kissed her so long and slow that my own cheeks started to burn because I was sure the neighbors would see. When he lifted his head, my mother's eyes were a color I had never seen before, and don't think I have ever seen again. "Trust me," he said, and then he threw the football to Kate. What I remember about that day was the way the ground bit back when you sat on it, the first hint of winter. I remember being tackled by my father, who always braced himself in a push-up so that I got none of the weight and all of his heat. I remember my mother cheering equally for both teams. And I remember throwing the ball to Jesse, but Kate getting in the way. An expression of absolute shock on her face as it landed in the cradle of her arms, and Dad yelled her on to the touchdown. She sprinted and nearly had it, but then Jesse took a running leap and slammed her to the ground, crushing her underneath him. In that moment, everything stopped. Kate lay with her arms and legs splayed, unmoving. My father was there in a breath, shoving at Jesse. "What the hell is the matter with you?" "I forgot." My mother, "Where does it hurt? Can you sit up?" But when Kate rolled over, she was smiling. "It doesn't hurt. It feels great." My parents looked at each other. Neither of them understood like I did, like Jesse did, that no matter who you are, there is some part of you that always wishes you were someone else. And when, for a millisecond, you get that wish, it's a miracle. He forgot, Kate said to nobody, and she lay on her back, beaming up at the cold Hawkeye sun. Hospital rooms never get completely dark. There is always some glowing panel behind the bed in case of catastrophe, a runway strip so that the nurses and doctors can find their way. I have seen Kate 100 times in beds like this one, although the tubes and wires change. She always looks smaller than I remember. I sit down as gently as I can. The veins on Kate's neck and chest are a road map, highways that don't go anywhere. I trick myself into believing that I can see those rogue leukemia cells moving like a rumor through her system. When she opens her eyes, I nearly fall off the bed. It's an exorcist moment. Anna? She says, staring right at me. I have not seen her look this scared since we were little, and Jesse convinced us that an old Indian ghost had come back to claim the bones buried by mistake under our house. If you have a sister and she dies, do you stop saying you have one? Or are you always a sister, even when the other half of the equation is gone? I crawl onto the bed, which is narrow but still big enough for both of us. I rest my head on her chest, so close to her central line that I can see the liquid dripping into her. Jesse is wrong. I didn't come to see Kate because it would make me feel better. I came because without her, it's hard to remember who I am.
Thursday. You, if you are sensible, when I tell you the stars flash signals, each one dreadful, you would not turn and answer me, "The night is wonderful." D.H. Lawrence, Under the Oak. Brian. We never know at first if we're headed into a cooker or a smudge. At 2:46 a.m. last night, the lights went on upstairs, the bells went off too, but I can't say that I ever really hear them. In 10 seconds, I was dressed and walking out the door of my room at the station. In 20, I was stepping into my turnout gear, pulling up the long elastic suspenders and shrugging into the turtle shell of my coat. By the time 2 minutes passed, Caesar was driving the engine onto the streets of Upper Darby. Polly and Red were the can man and the hydrant man, riding behind. Sometime after that, consciousness came in small, bright flashes. We remembered to check our breathing apparatus. We slid on our gloves. Dispatch called to tell us that the house was on Hoddington Drive, that it appeared to be either a structure fire or a room and contents fire. "Turn left here," I told Caesar. Hoddington was only 8 blocks away from where I lived. The house looked like the mouth of a dragon. Caesar drove around as far as he could, trying to get me a view of three sides. Then we all piled out of the engine and stared for a moment. 4 Davids against a Goliath. "Charge a 2.5 line, I told Caesar, tonight's motor pump operator. A woman in a nightgown ran toward me, sobbing, 3 children holding her skirt. "Mija," she screamed, pointing. "Mija!" "Donde está?" I got right in front of her so that she couldn't see anything but my face. "¿Cuántos años tiene?" She pointed to a window on the second floor. "Tres," she cried. "Cap," Caesar yelled. "We're ready over here." I heard the approaching whine of a second engine, the reserve guys coming to back us up. "Red, vent the northeast corner of the roof. Polly, put the wet stuff on the red stuff and push it out when it's got somewhere to go. We've got a kid on the second floor. I'm going in to see if I can get her." It wasn't, like in the movies, a slam dunk, a scene for the hero to go win his Oscar. If I got in there and the stairs had gone, if the structure threatened to collapse, if the temperature of the space had gotten so hot that everything was combustible and ripe for flashover, I would have backed out and told my men to back out with me. The safety of the rescuer is of a higher priority than the safety of the victim. Always. I'm a coward. There are times when my shift is over that I'll stay and roll hose or put on a fresh pot of coffee for the crew coming in, instead of heading straight to my house. I've often wondered why I get more rest in a place where, for the most part, I'm roused out of bed 2 or 3 times a night. I think it's because in a firehouse, I don't have to worry about emergencies happening. They're supposed to. The minute I walk through the door at home, I'm worrying about what might come next. Once, in 2nd grade, Kate drew a picture of a firefighter with a halo above his helmet. She told her class that I'd only be allowed to go to heaven, because if I went to hell, I'd put out all the fires. I still have that picture. In a bowl, I crack a dozen eggs and start to whip them into a frenzy. The bacon's already spitting on the stove, the griddle's heating for pancakes. Firemen eat together, or at least we try to, before the bells ring. The breakfast will be a treat for my guys, who are still showering away the memories of last night from their skin. Behind me, I hear the fall of footsteps. "Pull up a chair," I call over my shoulder. "It's almost ready." "Oh, thanks, but no," says a female voice. "I wouldn't want to impose." I turn around, brandishing my spatula. The sound of a woman here is surprising. One who's shown up just shy of 7 a.m. is even more remarkable. She's small, with wild hair that makes me think of a forest fire. Her hands are covered with winking silver rings. "Captain Fitzgerald, I'm Julia Romano. I'm the guardian ad litem assigned to Anna's case." Sarah's told me about her, though a woman the judge will listen to when push comes to shove. "Smells great," she says, smiling. She walks up and takes the spatula out of my hand. "I can't watch someone cook without helping. It's a genetic abnormality." I watch her reach into the fridge, rummaging around. Of all things, she comes back with a jar of horseradish. "I was hoping you might have a few minutes to talk."
"Sure." Horseradish.
She adds a good wad of the stuff to the eggs and then pulls orange zest off the spice rack along with some chili powder and sprinkles this on as well. "How's Kate doing?" I pour a circle of batter on the griddle. Watch it come to a bubble. When I flip it, it's an even, creamy brown. I've already spoken to Sarah this morning. Kate's night was uneventful. Sarah's wasn't, but that's because of Jesse. There's a moment during a structure fire when you know you're either going to get the upper hand or that it's going to get the upper hand on you. You notice the ceiling patch about to fall and the staircase eating itself alive and the synthetic carpet glued to the soles of your boots. The sum of the parts overwhelms, and that's when you back out and force yourself to remember that every fire will burn itself out, even without your help. These days, I'm fighting fire on 6 sides. I look in front of me and see Kate sick. I look behind me and see Anna with her lawyer. The only time Jesse isn't drinking like a fish, he's strung out on drugs. Sarah's grasping at straws, and me? I've got my gear on, safe. I'm holding dozens of hooks and irons and poles, all tools that are meant to destroy, when what I need is something to rope us together. "Captain Fitzgerald, Brian!" Julia Romano's voice knocks me out of my own head, into a kitchen that's rapidly filling with smoke. She reaches past me and shoves the pancake that's burning off the griddle. "Jesus." I drop the charcoal disc that used to be a pancake into the sink, where it hisses at me. "I'm sorry." Like open sesame, those 2 simple words change the landscape. "Good thing we've got the eggs," Julia Romano says. In a burning house, your 6th sense kicks in. You can't see because of the smoke. You can't hear because fire roars loud. You can't touch because it will be the end of you. In front of me, Polly manned the nozzle. A line of firefighters backed him up. A charged hose was a thick, dead weight. We worked our way up the stairs, still intact, intent on shoving this fire out the hole Red had put in the roof. Like anything that's confined, fire has a natural instinct to escape. I got down on my hands and knees and started to crawl through the hallway. The mother said it was the 3rd door on the left. The fire rolled along the other side of the ceiling, racing to the vent. As the spray attacked, white steam swallowed the other firefighters. The door to the child's room was open. I crawled in, calling her name. A larger shape at the window drew me like a magnet, but it turned out to be an oversized stuffed animal. I checked the closets and under the bed, too, but nobody was there. I backed into the hallway again and nearly tripped over the hose, fist thick. A human could think. A fire couldn't. A fire would follow a specific path. A child might not. Where would I have gone if I were terrified? Moving fast, I started poking my head into doorways. One was pink, a baby's room. Another had matchbox cars all over the floor and bunk beds. One was not a room at all, but a closet. The master bedroom was on the far side of the staircase. If I were a kid, I'd want my mother. Unlike the other bedrooms, this one was leaking thick black smoke. Fire had burned a seam at the bottom of the door. I opened it, knowing I was going to let in air, knowing it was the wrong thing to do and the only choice I had. Predictably, the smoldering line ignited, flame filling the doorway. I charged through it like a bull, feeling embers rain down the back of my helmet and coat. "Louisa!" I yelled out. I felt my way around the perimeter of the room, found the closet. I knocked hard and called again. It was faint, but there was definitely a knock back. "We've been lucky," I tell Julia Romano, quite possibly the last words she'd ever expect to hear me say. Sarah's sister watches the kids if it's going to be a long haul. For shorter runs, we swap off. You know, Sarah stays with Kate one night at the hospital and I go home to the other kids, or vice versa. It's easier now. They're old enough to take care of themselves. She writes something down in her little book when I say that, and it makes me squirm in my seat. Anna's only 13. Is that too young to stay alone in a house? Social services might say so. But Anna's different. Anna grew up years ago. "Do you think Anna's doing okay?" Julia asks. "I don't think she would have filed a lawsuit if she was." I hesitate. "Sarah says she wants attention. What do you think?" To buy time, I take a fork full of eggs. The horseradish turned out to be surprisingly good. It brings out the orange. I tell Julia Romano this. She folds her napkin next to her own plate. "You didn't answer my question, Mr. Fitzgerald." "I don't think it's that simple." I very carefully set my silverware down. "Do you have brothers or sisters?" "Both. 6 older brothers and a twin sister." I whistle. "Your parents must have had a hell of a lot of patience." She shrugs. "Good Catholics. I don't know how they did it either, but none of us fell through the cracks." "Did you always think so?" I ask. "Did you ever feel when you were a kid that maybe they were playing favorites?" Her face tightens just the tiniest bit, and I feel bad about putting her on the spot. "We all know you're supposed to love your kids equal, but that's not always how it works out." I get to my feet. "You got a little extra time? There's someone I'd like you to meet." Last winter, we got an ambulance call in the dead of winter for a guy who lived up a rural road. The contractor he hired to plow his driveway had found him and called 911. Apparently, the guy had gotten out of his car the night before, slipped, and froze right to the gravel. The contractor nearly ran over him, thinking he was adrift. When we got to the scene, he'd been outside for nearly 8 hours, and he was nothing more than an ice cube with no pulse. His knees were bent. I remember this because when we finally pried him out and set him on a backboard, there they were, sticking straight up in the air. We got the heat cranked in the ambulance and brought him inside, starting to cut off his clothes. By the time we had our paperwork in order for the hospital transport, the guy was sitting up and talking to us. I tell you this to show you that in spite of what you'd think, miracles happen. It's a cliche, but the reason I became a firefighter in the first place was because I wanted to save people. So the moment I emerged from the fiery arched doorway with Louisa in my arms, when her mother first saw us and fell to her knees, I knew I had done my job, and done it well. She swooped down beside the EMT from the second crew who got a line into the girl's arm and put her on oxygen. The kid was coughing, frightened, but she'd be fine. The fire was all but out. The boys were inside doing salvage and overhaul. Smoke drew a veil over the night sky. I couldn't make out a single star in the constellation Scorpio. I took off my gloves and wiped my hands across my eyes, which would sting for hours. "Good work," I said to Red as he packed up the hose. "Good save, Cap," he called back. It would have been better, of course, if Louisa had been in her own room, as her mother expected. But kids don't stay where they're supposed to. You turn around and find her not in the bedroom, but hiding in a closet. You turn around and see she's not 3, but 13. Parenting is really just a matter of tracking, of hoping your kids don't get so far ahead you can no longer see their next moves. I took off my helmet and stretched the muscles of my neck. I looked up at the structure that was once a home. Suddenly I felt fingers wrap around my hand. The woman who lived there stood with tears in her eyes. Her youngest was still in her arms. The other kids were sitting in the fire truck under Red's supervision. Silently, she raised my knuckles to her lips. A streak of soot came off my jacket to stripe her cheek. "You're welcome," I said. On our way back to the station, I directed Caesar the long way, so that we passed right down the street where I live. Jesse's Jeep sat in my driveway. The lights in the house were all off. I pictured Anna with the covers pulled up to her chin, like usual, Kate's bed empty.
"We all set, Fitz?" Caesar asked.
The truck was barely crawling, almost stopped directly in front of my driveway.
"Yeah, we're set," I said. "Let's take it on home."
I became a firefighter because I wanted to save people. But I should have been more specific. I should have named names.
Julia. Brian Fitzgerald's car is filled with stars. There are charts on the passenger seat and tables jammed into the console between us. The back seat is a pallet for Xerox copies of nebulae and planets. "Sorry," he says, reddening. "I wasn't expecting company." I help him clear off a space for me, and in the process pick up a map made of pinpricks. "What's this?" I ask. "A sky atlas," he shrugs. "It's kind of a hobby." When I was little, I once tried to name every star in the sky after one of my relatives. The scary part is, I hadn't run out of names by the time I fell asleep. "Anna's named after a galaxy," Brian says. "That's much cooler than being named after a patron saint," I muse. Once, I asked my mom why stars shine. She said they were night lights, so the angels could find a way around in heaven. But when I asked my dad, he started talking about gas, and somehow I put it all together and figured that the food God served caused multiple trips to the bathroom in the middle of the night. Brian laughs out loud. And here I was trying to explain atomic fusion to my kids. "Did it work?" He considers for a moment. "They could all probably find the Big Dipper with their eyes closed." "That's impressive. Stars all look the same to me." "It's not that hard. You spot a piece of a constellation, like Orion's Belt, and suddenly it's easier to find Rigel in his foot, and Betelgeuse in his shoulder." He hesitates. "But 90% of the universe is made of stuff we can't even see." "Then how do you know it's there?" He slows to stop at a red light. "Dark matter has a gravitational effect on other objects. You can't see it. You can't feel it. but you can watch something being pulled in its direction. 10 seconds after Campbell left last night, Izzy walked into the living room, where I was just on the cusp of having one of those bone-cleansing cries a woman should treat herself to at least once during a lunar cycle. "Yeah," she said dryly. "I can see this is a totally professional relationship." I scowled at her. "Were you eavesdropping?" "Pardon me if you and Romeo were having your little tête-à-tête through a thin wall." "If you've got something to say," I suggested, "say it." "Me?" Izzy frowned. "Hey, it's none of my business, is it?" "No, it's not." "Right. So I'll just keep my opinion to myself." I rolled my eyes. "Out with it, Isabel. Thought you'd never ask." She sat down beside me on the couch. "You know, Julia, the first time a bug sees that big purple zapper light, it looks like God. The second time, he runs in the other direction. First, don't compare me to a mosquito. Second, he'd fly in the other direction, not run. Third, there is no second time. The bug's dead." Izzy smirked. "You are such a lawyer." "I am not letting Campbell zap me." "Then request a transfer." "This isn't the Navy." I hugged one of the throw pillows from the couch. "And I can't do that. Not now. It'll make him think that I'm such a wimp I can't balance my professional life with some stupid, silly, adolescent incident." "You can't." Izzy shook her head. "He's an egotistical dickhead who's going to chew you up and spit you out. And you have a really awful history of falling for assholes that you ought to run screaming from. And I don't feel like sitting around listening to you try to convince yourself that you don't still feel something for Campbell Alexander when, in fact, you've spent the past 15 years trying to fill in the hole he made inside you." I stared at her. "Wow." She shrugged. "Guess I had a lot to get off my chest after all." "Do you hate all men, or just Campbell?" Izzy seemed to think about that for a while. "Just Campbell," she said finally. What I wanted at that moment was to be alone in my living room, so that I could throw things, like the TV remote, or the glass vase, or preferably my sister. But I couldn't order Izzy out of a house she'd moved into just hours before. I stood up and plucked my house keys off the counter. "I'm going out," I told her. "Don't wait up." I'm not much of a party girl, which explains why I hadn't frequented Shakespeare's Cat before, although it was a mere 4 blocks from my condo. The bar was dark and crowded and smelled of patchouli and cloves. I pushed my way inside, hopped up on a stool, and smiled at the man sitting next to me. I was in the mood to make out in the back row of the movie theater with someone who did not know my first name. I wanted 3 guys to fight for the honor of buying me a drink. I wanted to show Campbell Alexander what he'd been missing. The man beside me had sky eyes, a black ponytail, and a Cary Grant grin. He nodded politely at me, then turned away and began to kiss a white-haired gentleman flush on the mouth. I looked around and saw what I had missed on my entrance. The bar was filled with single men, but they were dancing, flirting, hooking up with each other. "What can I get you?" The bartender had fuchsia porcupine hair, and an oxen ring pierced through his nose.
"This is a gay bar?"
"No, it's the officers' club at West Point. You want a drink or not?" I pointed over his shoulder to the bottle of tequila, and he reached for a shot glass. I rummaged in my purse and pulled out a $50 bill. "The whole thing."
Glancing down at the bottle, I frowned. I bet Shakespeare didn't even have a cat. Who peed in your coffee? The bartender asked. Narrowing my eyes, I stared at him. You're not gay. Sure I am. Based on my track record, if you were gay, I'd probably find you attractive. As it is. I looked at the busy couple beside me, and then shrugged at the bartender. He blanched, then handed me back my 50. I tucked it back into my wallet. Who says you can't buy friends, I murmured. 3 hours later, I was the only person still there, unless you counted 7, which was what the bartender had rechristened himself last August, after deciding to jettison whatever sort of label the name Neil suggested. 7 stood for absolutely nothing, he had told me, which was exactly the way he liked it. Maybe I should be 6, I told him, when I'd made my way to the bottom of the tequila bottle. And you could be 9. 7 finished stacking the clean glasses. That's it. You're cut off. He used to call me Jewel, I said. And that was enough to make me start crying. A jewel's just a rock put under enormous heat and pressure. Extraordinary things are always hiding in places people never think to look. But Campbell had looked, and then he'd left me, reminding me that whatever he'd seen wasn't worth the time or effort. I used to have pink hair, I told 7. I used to have a real job, he answered. What happened? He shrugged. I dyed my hair pink. What happened to you? I let mine grow out, I answered. 7 wiped up a spill I'd made without noticing. Nobody ever wants what they've got, he said. Anna sits at the kitchen table by herself, eating a bowl of golden grams. Her eyes widen, surprised to see me with her father. But that's as much as she'll reveal. Fire last night, huh? She says, sniffing. Brian crosses the kitchen and gives her a hug. Big one. The arsonist? She asks. Doubt it. He goes for empty buildings. And this one had a kid in it. Who you saved? Anna guesses. You bet. He glances at me. I thought I'd take Julia up to the hospital. Want to come? She looks down at her bowl. I don't know. Hey, Brian lifts her chin. No one's going to keep you from seeing Kate. No one's going to be too thrilled to see me there, either, she says. The telephone rings and he picks it up. He listens for a moment and then smiles. That's great. That's so great. Yeah, of course I'm coming in. He hands the phone to Anna. Mom wants to talk to you, he says. And he excuses himself to change clothes. Anna hesitates, then curls her hand around the receiver. Her shoulders hunch, a small cubicle of personal privacy. Hello? And then, softly, really? She did? A few moments later, she hangs up. She sits down and takes another spoonful of cereal, then pushes away her bowl. Was that your mom? I ask, sitting down across from her. Yeah. Kate's awake, Anna says. That's good news. I guess. I put my elbows on the table. Why wouldn't it be good news? But Anna doesn't answer my question. She asked where I was. Your mother? Kate. Have you talked to her about your lawsuit, Anna? Ignoring me, she grabs the cereal box and begins to roll down the plastic insert. It's stale, she says. No one ever gets all the air out or closes the top right. Has anyone told Kate what's going on? Anna pushes on the box top to get the cardboard tab into its slot, to no avail. I don't even like golden grams. When she tries again, the box falls out of her arms and spills its contents all over the floor. Shoot. She crawls under the table, trying to scoop up the cereal with her hands. I get on the floor with Anna and watch her shove fistfuls into the liner. She won't look in my direction. We can always buy Kate some more before she gets home, I say gently. Anna stops and glances up. Without the veil of that secret, she looks much younger. Julia, what if she hates me? I tuck a strand of hair behind Anna's ear. What if she doesn't? The bottom line, Seven explained last night, is that we never fall for the people we're supposed to. I glanced at him, intrigued enough to muster the effort to raise my face from where it was plastered on the bar. It's not just me? Hell no. He set down a stack of clean glasses. Think about it. Romeo and Juliet bucked the system, and look where it got them. Superman has the hots for Lois Lane, when the better match, of course, would be with Wonder Woman. Dawson and Joey, need I say more? And don't even get me started on Charlie Brown and the little red-headed girl. What about you? I asked. He shrugged. Like I said, it happens to everyone. Leaning his elbows on the counter, he came close enough that I could see the dark roots beneath his magenta hair. For me, it was Lyndon. I'd break up with someone who was named for a tree, too, I sympathized. Guy or girl? He smirked. I'll never tell. So, what made her wrong for you? Seven sighed. Well, she... Ha! You said she! He rolled his eyes. Yes, Detective Julia. You've outed me at this gay establishment. Happy? Not particularly. I sent Lyndon back to New Zealand. Green card ran out. It was that or get married. What was wrong with her? Absolutely nothing, Seven confessed. She cleaned like a banshee. She never let me wash a dish. She listened to everything I had to say. She was a hurricane in bed. She was crazy about me. And believe it or not, I was the one for her. It was like 98% perfect. What about the other 2%? You tell me. He started stacking the clean glasses on the far side of the bar. Something was missing. I couldn't tell you what it was if you asked, but it was off. And if you think of a relationship as a living entity, I guess it's one thing if the missing 2% is like a fingernail. But when it's the heart, that's a whole different ball of wax. He turned to me. I didn't cry when she got on the plane. She lived with me for 4 years, and when she walked away, I didn't feel much of anything at all. Well, I had the other problem, I told him. I had the heart of the relationship, and nobody to grow it in. What happened then? What else? I said. It broke. The ridiculous irony is that Campbell was attracted to me because I stood apart from everyone else at the Wheeler School, and I was attracted to Campbell because I desperately wanted a connection with someone. There were comments, I knew, and stares sent our way, as his friends tried to figure out why Campbell was wasting his time with someone like me. No doubt, they thought I was an easy lay. But we weren't doing that. We met after school at the cemetery. Sometimes we would speak poetry to each other. Once, we tried to have an entire conversation without the letter S. We sat back to back and tried to think each other's thoughts, pretending clairvoyance, when it only made sense that his whole mind would be full of me and mine would be full of him. I loved the way he smelled whenever his head dipped close to hear what I was saying. Like the sun striking the cheek of a tomato, or soap drying on the hood of a car. I loved the way his hand felt on my spine. I loved. What if, I said one night, stealing breath from the edge of his lips, we did it. He was lying on his back, watching the moon rock back and forth on a hammock of stars. One hand was tossed up over his head, the other anchored me against his chest. Did what? I didn't answer. Just got up on one elbow and kissed him so deep that the ground gave way. Oh, Campbell said, hoarse. That. Have you ever? I asked. He just grinned. I thought that he'd probably fucked Muffy or Buffy or Puffy or all three in the baseball dugout at Wheeler, or after a party at one of their homes, when they both still smelled of Daddy's bourbon. I wondered why, then, he wasn't trying to sleep with me. I assumed that it was because I wasn't Muffy or Buffy or Puffy, but just Julia Romano, which wasn't good enough. Don't you want to? I asked. It was one of those moments where I knew we were not having the conversation that we needed to be having. And since I didn't really know what to say, never having crossed this particular bridge between thought and deed before, I pressed my hand up against the thick ridge in his pants. He backed away from me. Jewel, he said, I don't want you to think that's why I'm here. Let me tell you this. If you meet a loner, no matter what they tell you, it's not because they enjoy solitude. It's because they have tried to blend into the world before, and people continue to disappoint them. Then why are you here? Because you know all the words to American Pie? Campbell said. Because when you smile, I can almost see that tooth on the side that's crooked. He stared at me. Because you're not like anyone I've ever met. Do you love me? I whispered. Didn't I just say that? This time, when I reached for the buttons of his jeans, he didn't move away. In my palm, he was so hot, I imagined he would leave a scar. Unlike me, he knew what to do. He kissed and slipped, pushed, cracked me wide. Then he went perfectly still. You didn't say you were a virgin, he said. You didn't ask. But he'd assumed. He shuddered and began to move inside me, a poetry of limbs. I reached up to hold onto the gravestone behind me, words I could see in my mind's eye. Nora Dean, born 1832, died 1838. Jewel, he whispered when it was over. I thought. I know what you thought. I wondered what happened when you offered yourself to someone and they opened you, only to discover you were not the gift they expected, and they had to smile and nod and say thank you all the same. I blame Campbell Alexander entirely for my bad luck with relationships. It is embarrassing to admit, But I have only had sex with 3.5 other men. And none of those were any great improvement on my first experience. Let me guess, Seven said last night. The first was a rebound. The second was married.
How'd you know?
He laughed. Because you're a cliché. I swirled my pinky in my martini. It was an optical illusion, making the finger look split and crooked. The other one was from Club Med, a windsurfing instructor. That must have been worthwhile, Seven said. He was absolutely gorgeous, I answered, and had a dick the size of a cocktail, Frank. Ouch. Actually, I mused, you couldn't feel it at all. Seven grinned. So he was the half? I turned beet red. No, that was some other guy. I don't know his name, I admitted. I sort of woke up with him on top of me, after a night like this one. You, Seven pronounced, are a train wreck of sexual history. But this is inaccurate. A runaway train is an accident. Me? I'll jump in front of the tracks. I'll even tie myself down in front of the speeding engine. There's some illogical part of me that still believes if you want Superman to show up, first there's got to be someone worth saving. Kate Fitzgerald is a ghost just waiting to happen. Her skin is nearly translucent. Her hair so fair it bleeds into the pillowcase. How are you doing, baby? Brian murmurs, and he leans down to kiss her on the forehead. I think I might have to blow off the Iron Man competition, Kate jokes. Anna is hovering at the door in front of me. Sarah holds out her hand. It is all the encouragement Anna needs to crawl up on Kate's mattress. And in my mind, I mark off this small gesture from mother to child. Then Sarah sees me standing at the threshold. Brian, she says, what is she doing here? I wait for Brian to explain, but he doesn't seem inclined to utter a word. So I paste a smile on my face and step forward. I heard Kate was feeling better today, and I thought it might be a good time to talk to her. Kate struggles to her elbows. Who are you? I expect a fight from Sarah, but it is Anna who speaks up. I don't think this is such a good idea, she says, although she knows this is the very reason I've come here. I mean, Kate's still pretty sick. It takes me a moment, but then I understand. In Anna's life, everyone who ever talks to Kate takes Kate's side. She is doing what she can to keep me from defecting. You know Anna's right, Sarah hastily adds. Kate's only just turned a corner. I place my hand on Anna's shoulder. Don't worry. Then I turn to her mother. It's my understanding that you wanted this hearing. Sarah cuts me off. Miss Romano, could we have a word outside? We step into the hallway, and Sarah waits for a nurse to pass with a styrofoam tray of needles. I know what you think of me, she says. Mrs. Fitzgerald, she shakes her head. You're sticking up for Anna, and you should. I practiced law once, and I understand. It's your job, and part of that is figuring out what makes us, us. She rubs her forehead with one fist. My job is to take care of my daughters. One of them is extremely ill, and the other one's extremely unhappy. And I may not have it all figured out yet, but I do know that Kate won't get better any quicker If she finds out that the reason you're here is because Anna hasn't withdrawn her lawsuit yet. So I'm asking you not to tell her either. Please. I nod slowly, and Sarah turns to go back into Kate's room. With her hand on the door, she hesitates. I love both of them, she says. An equation I am supposed to be able to solve. I told Seven, the bartender, that true love is felonious. Not if they're over 18, he said, shutting the till of the cash register. By then, the bar itself had become an appendage, a second torso holding up my first. You take someone's breath away, I stressed. You rob them of the ability to utter a single word. I tipped the neck of the empty liquor bottle toward him. You steal a heart. He wiped up in front of me with a dish rag. Any judge would toss that case out on its ass. You'd be surprised. Seven spread the rag out on the brass bar to dry. Sounds like a misdemeanor if you ask me. I rested my cheek on the cool, damp wood. No way, I said. Once you're in, it's for life. Brian and Sarah take Anna down to the cafeteria. It leaves me alone with Kate, who is eminently curious. I imagine that the number of times her mother has willingly left her side is something she can count on two hands. I explain that I'm helping the family make some decisions about her health care. Ethics committee? Kate guesses. Or are you from the hospital's legal department? You look like a lawyer. What does a lawyer look like? Kind of like a doctor, when he doesn't want to tell you what your labs say. I pull up a chair. Well, I'm glad to hear you're doing better today. Yeah, apparently yesterday I was pretty out of it, Kate says. Doped up enough to make Ozzy and Sharon look like Ozzy and Harriet. Do you know where you stand, medically, right now? Kate nods. After my BMT, I got graft versus host disease, which is sort of good because it kicks the leukemia's butt, but it also does some funky stuff to your skin and organs. The doctors gave me steroids and cyclosporine to control it, and that worked, but it also managed to break down my kidneys, which is the emergency flavor of the month. That's pretty much the way it goes. Fix one leak in the dike just in time to watch another one start spouting. Something is always falling apart in me. She says this matter-of-factly, as if I've grilled her about the weather or what's on the hospital menu. I could ask her if she has talked to the nephrologists about a kidney transplant, if she has any particular feelings about undergoing so many different painful treatments. But this is exactly what Kate is expecting me to ask, which is probably why the question that comes out of my mouth is completely different. What do you want to be when you grow up? No one ever asks me that. She eyes me carefully. What makes you think I'm going to grow up? What makes you think that you're not? Isn't that why you're doing all this? Just when I think she isn't going to answer me, she speaks. I always wanted to be a ballerina. Her arm goes up, a weak arabesque. You know what ballerinas have? Eating disorders, I think. Absolute control. When it comes to their bodies, they know exactly what's going to happen and when. Kate shrugs, coming back to this moment, this hospital room. Anyway, she says, tell me about your brother. Kate starts to laugh. You haven't had the pleasure of meeting him yet, I guess. Not yet. You can pretty much form an opinion about Jesse in the first 30 seconds you spend with him. He gets into a lot of bad stuff he shouldn't. You mean drugs? Alcohol? Keep going, Kate says. Has that been hard for your family to deal with? Well, yeah. But I don't really think it's something he does on purpose. It's the way he gets noticed, you know? I mean, imagine what it would be like if you were a squirrel living in the elephant cage at the zoo. Does anyone ever go there and say, "Hey, check out that squirrel"? No, because there's something so much bigger you notice first. Kate runs her fingers up and down one of the tubes sprouting out of her chest. Sometimes it's shoplifting. Sometimes it's getting drunk. Last year, it was an anthrax hoax. That's the kind of stuff Jesse does. And Anna? Kate starts to pleat the blanket in folds on her lap. There was one year when every single holiday, and I mean even like Memorial Day, I was in the hospital. It wasn't anything planned, of course, but that's the way it happened. We had a tree in my room for Christmas, and an Easter egg hunt in the cafeteria, and we trick-or-treated on the orthopedic ward. Anna was around 6 years old, and she threw a total fit because she couldn't bring sparklers into the hospital on the 4th of July. All the oxygen tents. Kate looks up at me. She ran away. Not far or anything. I think she just got to the lobby before someone nabbed her. She was going to find herself another family, she told me. Like I said, she was only six, and no one really took it seriously. But I used to wonder what it would be like to be normal. So I totally understood why she'd wonder about it, too. When you're not sick, do you and Anna get along pretty well? We're like any pair of sisters, I guess. We fight over who gets to put on whose CDs. We talk about cute guys. We steal each other's good nail polish. She gets into my stuff and I yell. I get into her stuff and she cries down the house. Sometimes she's great. And other times I wish she'd never been born. That sounds so patently familiar that I grin. I have a twin sister. Every time I used to say that, my mother would ask me if I could really, truly picture being an only child. Could you? I laugh. Oh, there were definitely times I could imagine life without her. Kate doesn't crack a smile. See, she says. My sister's the one who's always had to imagine life without me.
Sarah, 1996. At eight, Kate is a long tangle of arms and legs, sometimes resembling a creature made of sunlight and pipe cleaners more than she does a little girl. I stick my head into her room for the third time that morning to find her in yet a different outfit. This one is a dress, white, with red cherries printed across it. "You're going to be late for your own birthday party," I tell her. Thrashing her way out of the halter top, Kate strips off the dress. "I look like an ice cream sundae." "There are worse things," I point out. "If you were me, would you wear the pink skirt or the striped one?" I look at them both, puddles on the floor. "The pink one. You don't like the stripes? Then wear that one." "I'm going to wear the cherries," she decides, and she turns around to grab it. On the back of her thigh is a bruise the size of a half dollar, a cherry that has stained its way through the fabric. "Kate," I ask, "what's that?" Twisting around, she looks at the spot where I point. "I guess I banged it." For 5 years, Kate has been in remission. At first, when the cord blood transplant seemed to be working, I kept waiting for someone to tell me this was all a mistake. When Kate complained that her feet hurt, I rushed her to Dr. Chance, certain this was the bony pain of recurrence, only to find out that she'd outgrown her sneakers. When she fell down, instead of kissing her scrapes, I'd ask her if her platelets were good. A bruise is created when there is bleeding in tissues beneath the skin, usually, but not always, the result of a trauma. It has been 5 whole years. Did I mention that? Anna sticks her head into the room. Daddy says the first car just pulled up, and if Kate wants to come down wearing a flour sack, he doesn't care. What's a flour sack? Kate finishes hiking the sundress over her head, then pulls up the hem and rubs the bruise. Huh, she says. Downstairs, there are 25 second graders, a cake in the shape of a unicorn, and a local college kid hired to make swords and bears and crowns out of balloons. Kate opens her presents, necklaces made of glittery beads, craft kits, Barbie paraphernalia. She saves the biggest box for last, the one Brian and I have gotten her. Inside a glass bowl swims a fantail goldfish. Kate has wanted a pet forever, but Brian is allergic to cats, and dogs require a lot of attention, which led us to this. Kate could not be happier. She carries him around for the rest of the party. She names him Hercules. After the party, when we are cleaning up, I find myself staring at the goldfish. Bright as a penny, he swims in circles, happy to be going nowhere. It takes only 30 seconds to realize that you will be canceling all your plans, erasing whatever you had been cocky enough to schedule on your calendar. It takes 60 seconds to understand that even if you've been fooled into thinking so, you do not have an ordinary life. A routine bone marrow aspiration, one we'd scheduled long before I ever saw that bruise, has come back with some abnormal promyelocytes floating around. Then a polymerase chain reaction test, one that allows the study of DNA, showed that in Kate, the 15 and 17 chromosomes were translocated. All of this means that Kate is in molecular relapse now, and clinical symptoms can't be that far behind. Maybe she won't present with blasts for a month. Maybe we won't find blood in her urine or stools for a year. But inevitably, it will happen. They say that word, relapse, like they might say birthday or tax deadline, something that happens so routinely it has become part of your internal calendar, whether you want it to or not. Dr. Chance has explained that this is one of the great debates for oncologists. Do you fix a wheel that isn't broken, or do you wait until the cart collapses? He recommends that we put Kate on all trans-retinoic acid. It comes in a pill half the size of my thumb and was basically stolen from ancient Chinese medics who'd been using it for years. Unlike chemotherapies, which go in and kill everything in their path, ATRA heads right for chromosome 17. Since the translocation of chromosomes 15 and 17 is in part what keeps promyelocyte maturation from happening correctly, ATRA helps uncoil the genes that have bound themselves together and stops the abnormalities from going further. Dr. Chance says the ATRA may put Kate back into remission. Then again, she might develop a resistance to it. Mom, Jessie comes into the living room, where I am sitting on the couch. I've been there for hours now. I can't seem to make myself get up and do any of the things I am supposed to do, because what is the point of packing school lunches, or hemming a pair of pants, or even paying the heating bill? Mom, Jesse says again, you didn't forget, did you? I look at him as if he's speaking Greek. What? You said you'd take me to buy new cleats after we go to the orthodontist. You promised. Yes, I did. Because soccer starts 2 days from now, and Jesse's outgrown his old pair. But now, I don't know if I can drag myself to the orthodontist's, where the receptionist will smile at Kate and tell me, like she always does, how beautiful my children are. And there is something about the thought of going to Sports Authority that seems downright obscene. I'm canceling the orthodontist appointment, I say. Cool, he smiles, his silver mouth glinting. Can we just go to get the cleats? Now is not a good time. But, Jesse, Let it go. I can't play if I don't get new shoes, and you're not even doing anything. You're just sitting here. Your sister, I say evenly, is incredibly sick. I'm sorry if that interferes with your dentist's appointment or your plan to go buy a pair of cleats, but those don't rate quite as high in the grand scheme of things right now. I'd think that since you're 10, you might be able to grow up enough to realize that the whole world doesn't always revolve around you. Jesse looks out the window, where Kate straddles the arm of an oak tree, coaching Anna in how to climb up. Yeah, right, she's sick, he says. Why don't you grow up? Why don't you figure out that the world doesn't revolve around her? For the first time in my life, I begin to understand how a parent might hit a child. It's because you can look into their eyes and see a reflection of yourself that you wish you hadn't. Jesse runs upstairs to slam the door to his bedroom. I close my eyes, take a few deep breaths. And it strikes me, not everyone dies of old age. People get run over by cars. People crash in airplanes. People choke on peanuts. There are no guarantees about anything, least of all one's future. With a sigh, I walk upstairs, knock on my son's door. He has just recently discovered music. It throbs through the thin line of light at the base of the door. As Jesse turns down the stereo, the notes flatten abruptly. What? I'd like to talk to you. I'd like to apologize. There is a scuffle on the other side of the door, and then it swings open. Blood covers Jesse's mouth, a vampire's lipstick. Bits of wire stick out like a seamstress's pins. I notice the fork he is holding and realize this is what he has used to pull off his braces. Now you never have to take me anywhere, he says. 2 weeks go by with Kate on ATRA. Did you know, Jesse says one day while I am getting her pill ready, a giant tortoise can live for 177 years? He is on a Ripley's Believe It or Not kick. An Arctic clam can live for 220 years. Anna sits at the counter, eating peanut butter with a spoon. What's an Arctic clam? Who cares, Jesse says. A parrot can live for 80 years. A cat can live for 30. How about Hercules? Kate asks. It says in my book that with good care, a goldfish can live for 7 years. Jesse watches Kate put the pill on her tongue, take a swig of water to swallow it. If you were Hercules, he said, you'd already be dead. Brian and I slide into our respective chairs in Dr. Chance's office. 5 years have passed, but the seats fit like an old baseball glove. Even the photographs on the oncologist's desk have not changed. His wife is wearing the same broad-brimmed hat on a rocky Newport jetty. His son is frozen at age 6, holding a speckled trout, contributing to the feeling that, in spite of what I believed, we never really left here. The ATRA worked. For a month, Kate reverted to molecular remission, and then a CBC turned up more promyelocytes in her blood. We can keep pulsing her with ATRA, Dr. Chance says, but I think its failure already tells us she's maxed out that course. What about a bone marrow transplant? That's a risky call, particularly for a child who still isn't showing symptoms of a full-blown clinical relapse. Dr. Chance looks at us. There's something else we can try first. It's called a donor lymphocyte infusion, a DLI. Sometimes a transfusion of white blood cells from a matched donor can help the original clone of cord blood cells fight the leukemia cells. Think of them as a relief army, supporting the front line. Will it put her into remission? Brian asks. Dr. Chance shakes his head. It's a stopgap measure. Kate will, in all probability, have a full-fledged relapse, but it buys time to build up her defenses before we have to rush into a more aggressive treatment. And how long will it take to get the lymphocytes here? I ask. Dr. Chance turns to me. That depends. How soon can you bring in Anna? When the elevator doors open, there is only one other person inside it, a homeless man with electric blue sunglasses and 6 plastic grocery bags filled with rags. "Close the doors, damn it!" he yells as soon as we step inside. "Can't you see I'm blind?" I push the button for the lobby. "I can take Anna in after school. Kindergarten gets out at noon tomorrow." "Don't touch my bag!" the homeless man growls. "I didn't," I answer, distant and polite. "I don't think you should," Brian says. "I'm nowhere near him." "Sarah, I meant the DLI. I don't think you should take Anna in to donate blood." For no reason at all, the elevator stops on the 11th floor, then closes again. The homeless man begins to rummage in his plastic bags. "When we had Anna," I remind Brian, "we knew that she was going to be a donor for Kate. Once. And she doesn't have any memory of us doing that to her." I wait until he looks at me. "Would you give blood for Kate?" "Jesus, Sarah, what kind of question?" "I would, too. I'd give her half my heart, for God's sake, if it helped." "You do whatever you have to when it comes to people you love, right?" Brian ducks his head, nods. "What makes you think that Anna would feel any different?" The elevator doors open, but Brian and I remain inside, staring at each other. From the back, the homeless man shoves between us, his bounty rustling in his arms. "Stop yelling!" he shouts, though we stand in utter silence. "Can't you tell that I'm deaf?" To Anna, it is a holiday. Her mother and father are spending time with her, alone. She gets to hold both of our hands the whole way across the parking lot. So what if we're going to a hospital? I have explained to her that Kate isn't feeling good, and that the doctors need to take something from Anna and give it to Kate to make her feel better. I figured that was more than enough information. We wait in the examination room, coloring line drawings of pterodactyls and T-Rexes. "Today at snack, Ethan said that the dinosaurs all died because they got a cold," Anna says. "But no one believed him." Brian grins. "Why do you think they died?" "Because, duh, they were a million years old." She looks up at him. "Did they have birthday parties back then?" The door opens, and the hematologist comes in. "Hello, gang. Mom, you want to hold her on your lap?" So I crawl onto the table and settle Anna in my arms. Brian gets stationed behind us so that he can grab Anna's shoulder and elbow and keep it immobilized. "You ready?" the doctor asks Anna, who is still smiling. And then she holds up a syringe. "It's only a little stick," the doctor promises. Exactly the wrong words, and Anna starts thrashing. Her arms clip me in the face, the belly. Brian cannot grab hold of her. Over her screams, he yells at me, "I thought you told her!" The doctor, who's left the room without me even noticing, returns with several nurses in tow. "Kids and phlebotomy never mix well," she says, as the nurses slide Anna off my lap and soothe her with their soft hands and softer words. "Don't worry, we're pros." It is a déjà vu, just like the day Kate was diagnosed. "Be careful what you wish for," I think. Anna is just like her sister. I'm vacuuming the girls' room when the handle of the Electrolux smacks Hercules's bowl and sends the fish flying. No glass breaks, but it takes me a moment to find him, thrashing himself dry on the carpet beneath Kate's desk. "Hang on, buddy," I whisper, and I flip him into the bowl. I fill it with water from the bathroom sink. He floats to the top. "Don't," I think. "Please." I sit down on the edge of the bed. How can I possibly tell Kate I've killed her fish? Will she notice if I run to the pet store and get a replacement? Suddenly, Anna is next to me, home from morning kindergarten. "Mommy, how come Hercules isn't moving?" I open my mouth, a confession melting on my tongue. But at that moment, the goldfish shudders sideways, dives, and starts to swim again. "There," I say. "He's fine." When 5,000 lymphocytes don't seem to be enough, Dr. Chance calls for 10,000. Anna's appointment for a second donor lymphocyte draw falls in the middle of the gymnastics birthday party of a girl in her class. I agree to let her go for a little while and then drive to the hospital from the gym. The girl is a sugar-spun princess with fairy white hair, a tiny replica of her mother. As I slip off my shoes to trek across the padded floor, I try desperately to remember their names. The child is Mallory, and the mother is Monica? Margaret? I spot Anna right away, sitting on the trampoline as an instructor bounces them up and down like popcorn. The mother comes over to me, a smile strung on her face like a row of Christmas lights. "You must be Anna's mom. I'm Mitty," she says. "I'm so sorry she has to leave, but of course we understand. It must be amazing, going somewhere no one else ever gets to go." "The hospital?" "Well, just hope you never have to do the same." "Oh, I know. I get dizzy going up an elevator." She turns to the trampoline. "Anna, honey, your mother's here." Anna barrels across the padded floor. This is exactly what I'd wanted to do to my living room when the kids were all small, cushion the walls and floor and ceiling for protection. And yet, it turned out that I could have rolled Kate in bubble wrap. The danger for her was already under the skin. "What do you say?" I prompt, and Anna thanks Mallory's mother. "Oh, you're welcome." She hands Anna a small bag of treats. "Now, have your husband call us any time. We'd be happy to take Anna while you're in Texas." Anna hesitates in the middle of a shoelace knot. "Mitty," I ask, "what exactly did Anna tell you?" "That she had to leave early so your whole family could take you to the airport, because once training starts in Houston, you won't see them until after the flight."
"The flight?
On the space shuttle?" For a moment, I am stunned. That Anna would make up such a ridiculous story, that this woman would believe it. "I'm not an astronaut," I confess. I don't know why Anna would even say something like that. I pull Anna to her feet, one shoelace still untied. Dragging her out of the gymnasium, we reach the car before I say a word. "Why did you lie to her?" Anna scowls. "Why did I have to leave the party?"
"Because your sister is more important than cake and ice cream. Because I cannot do this for her. Because I said so."
I'm so angry that I have to try twice before I can unlock the van. "Stop acting like a 5-year-old," I accuse. And then I remember that's exactly what she is. "It was so hot," Brian says. "A silver tea set melted. Pencils were bent in half." I look up from the newspaper. "How did it start?" "Cat and dog chasing each other when the owners were on vacation. They turned on a Gen Air range." He peels his jeans down, winces. "I got second-degree burns just kneeling on the roof." His skin is raw, blistered. I watch him apply Neosporin and gauze. He keeps talking, telling me something about a rookie nicknamed Caesar who just joined their company. But my eyes are drawn to the advice column in the newspaper. "Dear Abby, every time my mother-in-law visits, she insists on cleaning out the refrigerator. My husband says she's just trying to help, but it makes me feel like I'm being judged. She's made my life a wreck. How do I make this woman stop without ruining my marriage? Sincerely, past my expiration date, Seattle." What sort of woman considers this to be her biggest problem? I picture her scrawling out a note to Dear Abby on linen blend stationery. I wonder if she's ever felt a baby turn inside her, tiny hands and feet walking in slow circles, as if the inside of a mother is a place to be carefully mapped. "What are you glued to?" Brian asks, coming to read the column over my shoulder. I shake my head in disbelief. "A woman whose life is being ruined by rings from jelly jars." "Cream gone bad," Brian adds, chuckling. "Slimy lettuce. Oh my God, how can she stand to be alive?" We both start laughing then. contagious. All we have to do is look at each other to laugh even harder. And then, just as suddenly as all this was funny, it isn't anymore. Not all of us live in a world where our refrigerator contents are the barometer of our personal happiness. Some of us work in buildings that are burning down around us. Some of us have little girls who are dying. Slimy fucking lettuce, I say, my voice hitching. It's not fair. Brian is across the room in an instant. He folds me into his embrace. It never is, baby, he answers. 1 month later, we go back for a third lymphocyte donation. Anna and I take our seats in the doctor's office, waiting to be called. After a few minutes, she tugs on my sleeve. Mommy, she says. I glance down at her. Anna is swinging her feet. On her fingernails is Kate's mood-changing nail polish. What? She smiles up at me. In case I forget to tell you after, it wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. One day my sister arrives unannounced, and with Brian's permission, spirits me away to a penthouse suite at the Ritz-Carlton in Boston. We can do anything you want, she tells me. Art museums, Freedom Trail walks, dinners out on the harbor. But what I really want to do is just forget. And so, 3 hours later, I am sitting on the floor beside her, finishing our second $100 bottle of wine. I lift the bottle by its neck. I could have bought a dress with this. Zan snorts. At Filene's basement, maybe. Her feet are on a brocade chair. Her body is sprawled on the white carpet. On the TV, Oprah counsels us to minimize our lives. Plus, when you zip up a great Pinot Noir, you never look fat. I look over at her, suddenly feeling sorry for myself. No, you're not doing the crying thing. Crying is not included in the room rate. But suddenly all I can think of is how stupid the women on Oprah sound, with their stuffed filofaxes and crammed closets. I wonder what Brian made for dinner. If Kate's all right. I'm going to call home. She comes up on an elbow. You are allowed to take a break, you know. No one has to be a martyr 24/7. But I hear her wrong. I think once you sign on to be a mother, that's the only shift they offer. I said martyr, Zan laughs, not mother. I smile a little. Is there a difference? She takes the telephone receiver out of my hand. Did you want to get your crown of thorns out of the suitcase first? Listen to yourself, Sarah, and stop being such a drama queen. Yes, you drew a bad lot of fate. Yes, it sucks to be you. Bright color rises on my cheeks. You have no idea what my life is like. Neither do you, Zan says. You're not living, Sarah. You're waiting for Kate to die. I am not... I begin, but then I stop. The thing is, I am. Zan strokes my hair and lets me cry. It is so hard sometimes, I confess. Words I have not said to anyone, not even Brian. As long as it's not all the time, Zan says. Honey, Kate is not going to die sooner because you have one more glass of wine, or because you stay overnight in a hotel, or because you let yourself crack up at a bad joke. So sit your ass back down and turn up the volume and act like you're a normal person. I look around at the opulence of the room, at our decadent sprawl of wine bottles and chocolate strawberries. Zan, I say, wiping my eyes, this is not what normal people do. She follows my gaze. You're absolutely right. She picks up the remote control, flipping channels until she finds Jerry Springer. That better? I start to laugh, and then she starts to laugh, and soon the room is spinning around me, and we are lying on our backs, staring up at the crown molding edging the ceiling. I suddenly remember how, when we were kids, Zan used to always walk ahead of me to the bus stop. I could have run and caught up, but I never did. I only wanted to follow her. Laughter rises like steam, swims through the windows. After 3 days of a torrential downpour, the kids are delighted to be outside, kicking around a soccer ball with Brian. When life is normal, it is so normal. I duck into Jesse's room, trying to navigate strewn Lego pieces and comic books so that I can set his clean clothes down on the bed. Then I go into Kate and Anna's room and separate their folded laundry. When I place Kate's T-shirts on her dresser, I see it. Hercules is swimming upside down. I reach into the bowl and turn him, holding his tail. He wafts for a few strokes and then floats slowly to the surface, white-bellied and gasping. I remember Jesse saying that with good care, a fish might live 7 years. This has only been 7 months. After carrying the fishbowl into my bedroom, I pick up the phone and dial information. Petco, I say. When I'm connected, I ask a clerk about Hercules. Do you, like, want to buy a new fish? She asks. No, I want to save this one. Ma'am, the girl says, we're talking about a goldfish, right? So I call 3 vets, none of whom treat fish. I watch Hercules in his death throes for another minute, and then ring the oceanography department at URI, asking for any professor that's available. Dr. Orestes studies tide pools, he tells me, mollusks and shellfish and sea urchins, not goldfish. But I find myself telling him about my daughter, who has APL,